Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Talofa, Malo, Bulavanaka, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. It is Tuesday, March 24. I'm Kyle Evans, and thanks for tuning in. We've got another big show coming up this morning. We'll head to the Solomon Islands, where confidence is growing among opposition MPs who say they are now a government in waiting.
So if your Prime Minister, you see more than half your cabinet resigning, that should be a sign that there is no confidence in your leadership.
Also, a new study uncovers microplastics in Fiji's drinking water.
And I think the message that is going across to the people is that they should not start discarding plastics unwisely.
An anti-independence group strengthened their grip in New Caledonia with big wins in the second round of the municipal elections. We've got all that and more coming up. I'm Kyle Evans. Let's get started. But first to the Solomon Islands, where the political uncertainty is continuing. A new coalition opposing Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele say they're the government in waiting, with their 28 MPs holding the majority of seats in Parliament. But PM Manele told media on Sunday he would only recall Parliament at an appropriate time and downplayed the political numbers against him. Opposition MP and coalition spokesperson Peter Canaloria Jr. says the PM's comment is both unacceptable and deeply misrepresented. He told the ABC's reporter in Solomon Islands, Chris and Rita Amanu Leong, that the PM must either resign now or call Parliament to test his numbers in a no-confidence vote.
Well, I think that's something for those that resigned to perhaps answer. No, I think there was perhaps some other factors at play that got them to make a decision to resign when they did. So I think that's perhaps a question perhaps directed to them. Those of us who are on this side, we are there, and we're happy in the sense that they came to join us, you know, that sort of thing. So the issue of timing, I think, is something that perhaps they had other factors at play, knowing full well that Parliament is not sitting.
There's been a lot of interpretation of how everything is playing out. What's your interpretation?
Yeah, so I think certain parts of what we're doing is already in uncharted waters in terms of the constitution and the different roles the executive has, Parliament has, you know, with the chairmanship and the select standing committee. So you had ministers resigning, you have parliamentary select committee chairs resigning, and there's an undertaking within this group that we will not accept any chairmanship or even membership in the parliamentary select committees. So I think there are certain issues at play now that are put us in new territory when it comes to governance issues and how perhaps to solve them. But I think it just comes back down to us. You know, so we have systems, we have provisions, we have the constitution. But I think as leaders, it just comes back to us. Like, what is it that we're trying to do here? So if you're Prime Minister, you see more than half your cabinet resigning, you know, that should be a sign that there is no confidence in your leadership any longer. So I think, you know, it's incumbent upon us as leaders, the Prime Minister, to act despite court cases, precedents, constitutional provisions and all of that, that perhaps might drag things a bit longer.
It's a week of uncertainty. What can you say about the unifying factor here? I understand there's multi-parties coming together to form this coalition. What can you say is the unifying factor in this camp?
Yeah, I would say, just listening from colleagues that have joined us, that the environment that they say they feel here is totally different from where they came from. you know, within the GNAT. I think you heard Honorable Langovaka talking about using the word toxic. And also in a relationship, if it starts to get toxic, and then that's not conducive towards working together. So I think that's the biggest breath of fresh air for many of them, is that coming across here and out of that so-called toxic environment is something that's helping us gel together. And the camaraderie that over the last week that we have built upon in staying together, and a little bit of adversity we're facing, you know, it takes a little bit of adversity to bond closer. So all this adversity, you know, in fact just brings it even more closer, that we're going through this together. Ministers resigned, us as chairmanship also resigned. We're in solidarity together in this move, and where the resolve is so strong.
Has there been discussions on who will be person in charge or the leader that the coalition has agreed to?
Well, we haven't had, you know, that's a discussion that I think we'll put for later. But as the colleague, Honorable Langovaka, mentioned, according to the Political Parties Integrity Act, it's the party with the biggest majority that would, from among them, have the leader. So the biggest party is People First Party. So for us, that's the rule of thumb. Unless they want to give it away, that's up to them. That is what the Political Party Integrity Act says. But currently, we are just looking at that act for guidance.
Do you know, or have you been approached perhaps from the government side? I know there's some allegations out online as well of some form of bribery for some of the members here to join the government side.
Yeah, I don't know about bribery and that, but there's always been reach out, you know, for members to go back and join government or rejoin government. Some of us who have never been in government have also been reached out to, but for someone like me, I think my phone has been pretty dead in terms of that particular activity that does happen in terms of sometimes the so-called fluidity of government and that sort of thing. There's been offers been made, you know, to a number of our colleagues here, but the bottom line is that no one's biting. And there is a strong resolve here that we are already the government in waiting. The number is already here. We will be forming the next government in Solomon Islands. And that sort of overrides all other considerations that perhaps people might want to calculate when it comes to these kinds of situations. But indeed, there has been outreach by the government as well in terms of what it is that they want to do in regaining their numbers.
And final question, you mentioned the rule of thumb there when it comes to the political party with the majority. If they reached out to you, or if they chose you to become the next prime minister, what would be your answer?
Oh my goodness, that would be a big shock, a big surprise, knowing the makeup of our group and that. But you know, when such an honor has been bestowed upon somebody, you should take it seriously. So of course, anybody who'd been asked to take up some leadership form would take it seriously, you know, in terms of seriously consider it, including myself.
Solomon Islands MP Peter Kalinoria Jr. He's a member of that new coalition challenging the leadership for Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele. But as of now, the cards are in the PM's hands with no date yet set for Parliament. The opposition, meanwhile, is seeking a judicial intervention to force the PM's hand. In the meantime, Mr. Manele may well have gained support on the football pitch after announcing a new funding package for the club's first fully professional football club, the Solomon Kings. He's gifted the Kings $5.4 million to back the club as it heads into round 5 of the OFC Pro League. It comes after Honiara hosted round 4 of the competition and filled the national stadium to capacity for both the Kings matches.
The Solomon Islands government is supporting the Solomon Kings with SBD $4 million. Football is a force of unity and stability in our nation, and this support reflects one of GNAT's policy pillars, and that is stability and unity. I encourage all Solomon Islanders to continue supporting the Solomon Kings as they progress to the next leg of the Pro League. I was happy to watch both of their games while they were in Honiara, and I urge our people to continue cheering for them wherever the league takes them. On behalf of the government, I wish the Solomon Kings all the best in their upcoming matches.
Solomon Islands Prime Minister Jeremiah Minelli announcing that funding package for the Kings, who have found support not only with the fans, but with the government as well, it seems. And they currently sit fourth on the competition ladder, with Fijian club Bulla FC rising into third place following back-to-back Kings losses. South Melbourne FC sits second, while Auckland FC sits on top of the ladder.
Discover the stories that shape our region on Culture Compass. Travel across the Pacific with Afmasanga Sayuli Salamasina von Reiki as she traces the shift from oral traditions to online connections, explores the delicate balance between conservation and cultural practice, and follows the ukulele's journey across the islands. Culture Compass, a journey through resilience, revival and deep connection. Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. A study by the University of the South Pacific has found that Fijians are drinking water contaminated with microplastics every day. This includes tap water, groundwater, and even rainwater. Unsurprisingly, it's raised concerns about water safety and public health. Finau Fanua spoke to one of the researchers, Associate Professor David Rohindra.
Yes, this microplastic in drinking water is not only found in Fiji. I think it is across the world. Every country now has got a problem with microplastics in either drinking water or food they eat or the air they breathe. But looking at our condition in Fiji, I think we are still below some of the other countries' level. But what we are trying to show is that the baseline study shows that we are actually ingesting microplastics and different types of water with different types of treatment. And I think the message that is going across to the people is that they should not start discarding plastics unwisely, because based on that, microplastics are basically being generated. So what we look at here is that the message that goes across to the people is that our water at the moment is quite below the critical level of many other countries, quite safe at the moment, but unfortunately we are taking in plastic.
I read that even the rainwater supplies have microplastics. How did that happen?
Well, I think what happens is that those plastics which are basically being discarded from industries, they get into the air. And when condensation happens, basically these microplastics come down with the rain. So I think this is, again, not only confined to Fiji. This is also found in other countries as well. But looking at the amount that we got in rainwater is basically very low. Very, very low, I would say. But then we were actually collecting this water from these plastic tanks that we are actually using in Fiji. So probably some of the plastic that we identified could be coming out from these plastic tanks as well, or sea level.
Is it possible to get rid of microplastics from water? Can it be treated?
That's a very good question. I think despite these water treatment plants around the world not designed to remove microplastics, but we have seen that our treatment plants here are able to remove close to about 50 to 60% of microplastics, basically on the condition that they are able to attract those microplastics onto these aluminium sulfate colloglands which are they using. So basically, your question about whether we could treat it, its research is still going on. My research group is working on using natural materials to see if we can remove microplastics. We published a few papers showing that using crab shells, one of the waste materials that can be modified to attract plastics. The world is also working along it as well. So we hope that we should be able to find a resolution soon.
Does this have impacts on people's health, having microplastics? We drink water every day.
That question, I think, is I cannot answer it, because we do not have any data to show the link between microplastic and human health.
How does most microplastics get into water sources? Is it from people just discarding it into the environment, or is it from smoke going into the air? How does microplastics mostly get into the water sources?
You may have come to know this some years ago when people were trying to get rid of plastic pollution. They said out of sight, out of mind. Then they started adding some additives to plastic so that they can start degrading. So degradation means that they break down into smaller pieces, but they do not get back into nature. That is, they don't convert into carbon dioxide or water. They remain a small plastic. So what happens is that when they become too small in size, then they start getting washed away with, into the aquatic environment. And then after that, it might end up into where there is the water sources from which the water treatment plants are actually using those water to treat and then provide it to the consumers. So the question here is that if we stop discarding these degradable plastics unwisely or improperly, then probably we should be able to stop a lot of these degraded plastic going into the environment.
I guess another theme is that we should use less plastic in the ocean,
yes,
less plastic in our drinking water sources, right?
Well, I think what we should be looking at is that, when we are knowing that plastics is now creating problems, not only in terms of microplastic, but in terms of volume taken up in the landfills, people are trying to use different methods like pyrolysis, burning of plastics. And you know that these chemical compounds that are actually used to make these plastics are sometimes harmful if we don't discard them or recycle them properly. So my suggestion to people now is that they should start investing in substitutes. For example, trying to use traditional materials from nature. For example, bamboo-based cutleries, bamboo-based plates. So we should be able to cut down a lot on plastics.
That was Associate Professor David Rohindra from the University of the South Pacific. We turn to New Caledonia now, where anti-independence groups have strengthened their hold on the French territory with big wins in the second round of the municipal elections. Loyalist Sonia Lagarde won 62% of votes in Noumea in the territory's first local elections since the 2024 riots in the capital. So what does this mean for the political tug of war between the pro-independence groups and the loyalists? Well, joining us this morning to help us answer that question is Ireland Business correspondent Nick McClellan. Nick, welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Kyle.
Let's start not by talking about the results, but about the significance of this election. What are they and why are they an important barometer to gauge the politics in the territory at the moment?
Right across France, both in Europe and its overseas colonies, municipal elections have been held over the last two weekends. France has a system of two rounds of elections. The municipal elections are slightly different to other local elections in New Caledonia in that the electorate is all French nationals aged 18 and above registered at the town hall. So it's not the restricted electorate that you see for other issues like the referendums we've seen in New Caledonia or the provincial elections, which are due later this year. This is very much about local politics. Despite that, these elections are also a barometer about the balance of forces within and between both camps, the pro-independence parties and those that are so-called loyal to France. And as you mentioned, the loyalists, the most conservative grouping of anti-independence parties, had a very strong showing in Greater Noumea. But it's worth noting that there is also a very strong showing by independence forces in the rural provinces in both the North and the Loyalty Islands. So it's quite a mixed bag and quite a complex result to analyse.
Yeah, well, let's start with those urban results because, yeah, the non-independence bloc, they won a decisive victory with 62% of the vote. Were you surprised by the outcome?
No, not really, because, in fact, there was a battle within the anti-independence camp. The group Les Loyalistes, the Loyalists, led by Sonia Bakes and Nicolas Metzdorf, ran against another major conservative anti-independence party, Rassemblement, and the Loyalists won in all four major battles, the actual capital, Noumea, and then three surrounding towns, Mondor, Païta and Doumbéa. And it was a significant victory. Sonia Lagarde, the outgoing mayor, won the capital, Noumea, She just faltered by 8 votes in the first round. She almost won without having to go to a runoff, but had a significant victory for Namur itself. But the significance was, for example, in Mondor, a town that was badly cut off during the 2024 conflict. They ousted the long-standing mayor from Rassemblement Party and appointed a young woman named Nina Julier. So in all these cases, there's local issues. You know, municipal elections are local council elections. There's issues about roads and rates. They're very much about local personalities as much as broader party politics. But, you know, it's clear that the legacies of the 2024 conflict, the 6 months of conflict in Noumea and the surrounding areas during 2024 has had an impact. As I say, though, it's important to say that, you know, the voters in this election are all French nationals, and not just the restricted electorate of New Caledonian. And so you've seen that enormous victory for the loyalists across Greater Noumea. But it's a very different picture elsewhere, and the battleground there was between two pro-independence groupings, the FLNKS, the main independence coalition, but also the breakaway UNI, the Union for National Independence, which is particularly the party Palika. Once again, there's a test of wills between those two groupings. The other significant feature of this election, there were also a number of so-called citizens' lists. These are lists that didn't identify as one political party or another, and they had some significant victories. These are local people who'd got together and said, this is about local concerns rather than the broader politics of New Caledonia. And so, for example, in the northern province, the capital, Kone, was won by a ticket of local citizens that came together not on a party political basis. That's a reflection of the closure of the main smelter in the northern province, of terrible economic conditions in the north since 1,200 people lost their jobs with the smelter closing. So these are, you know, it's a real mix. And these citizens' movements in a number of places right across the country, in the cities and in the rural areas, did pretty well, even though they often didn't win the seats.
So, I mean, I'm sure it's complex, but what do we know about, what drove the votes of voters what their values were heading into this election?
Look, I think it's a mixture, as I say, of local issues, but also it's a real debate around the future of New Caledonia. As listeners to the program will know, over the last year or so, France has been attempting to develop a new political statute to replace the Noumea Accord. That's the framework agreement signed in 1998 that's governed the country for the last quarter of a century. The riots and conflict in 2024 was a reaction to France trying to ram through changes to voting rules around this question. Just as we speak, coming up this week, there'll be the debate within the French National Assembly about legislation proposing to introduce the so-called Bougival Accord. This was an agreement put together in July 2025. Five out of six major political groupings have supported this, but not the main independence coalition, FLNKS. It passed through the Senate, the Bougival Accord, in February, and it will be debated this week. And so, you know, the vote in the municipal elections also sends a bit of a signal to people in Paris about the balance of forces. But that really hasn't changed. The independence movement did, FLNKS did really well with victories in the islands, Uvea and Lifu, on the main east coast, in Wailu, in Yengen, in Tuo, down south in Yate even. And also, there's a generational change in some places. The current president of New Caledonia, Alcide Ponga, had been mayor of Kwawa, a mining town. He lost his seat, just as one of the old guard of the Union Caledonian Party, Gilbert Tuyenon, who'd been mayor of Canala for 25 years, also lost his seat. So there's going to be a lot of poring over the entrails of this election by the different parties. But time will move on. The main test is really about what happens with the provincial elections. These are on a restricted electorate of New Caledonians. They'll either be held in June this year or before December, depending on what happens this week in the National Assembly. And so the municipals set the reality that there's still a divided country in many ways. You know, the loyalists, the anti-independence parties have had a strong showing in Greater Noumea, and that's a reflection that most of the clashes and conflict in 2024 were in Noumea and surrounding towns. But the independence movement battled it out with mixed results all around the rest of the country. That fundamental division between people who want a move to independence and those that want to remain within the French Republic has played out. The loyalists are claiming that everyone supports Bougival. That's not true. But, you know, as I say, they've had a significant victory in the capital and in Mondor, Paita, Doumbéa. We'll have to see what happens in Paris in coming days as to the next steps for New Caledonia.
And it sounds like the fault line of that divide is increasingly between urban and rural voters. Is that sort of a fair assumption to make?
No, there's a mixture. You know, it's certainly true that historically the Loyalty Islands, for example, where the population is more than 90% Indigenous Kanak, have always voted for one or other independence party. And we've saw over the municipal elections, there's been a real tussle between the major groupings, Union Caledonienne, Palika, Parti Travailliste to a certain extent, Dynamite Autochtone. You know, people, but also for local elections, people vote for personalities they know. You often had some real changes where someone who's been a mayor has done a pretty crappy job over the last few years, and so they've been replaced. These are, you know, it's a small country, and so often personalities play as much role as politics when it comes to deciding who's going to govern the local town hall. But there's certainly indicators of what this means for the looming provincial elections, which are crucial because with the provincial elections, the three provincial assemblies make up the National Congress, and from the Congress, the government is elected in New Caledonia. And so later this year, we're going to see a major change depending on what happens with the passage or otherwise of legislation in Paris in the coming days.
Mm. I mean, one of the things I found interesting is that, yes, while there's a lot of variables that go into how people vote, turnout was quite low, I understand. So who was staying home and why?
It varied from place to place. In New Caledonia, in Noumea, in the capital, turnout was relatively low. One of the complaints was that the French High Commission had melded together the polling booths in the past elections. So going back even pre-COVID, there were over 50 polling booths at the last municipal elections. There were 56 polling booths, you know, usually held at town halls or local schools, community buildings, anywhere where a polling booth can be set up. This time those were melded together into 8 polling booths. So from 56 to 8. And that meant for some people, they had, you know, some distance to get to a polling booth. And there was a lot of complaints from people in the working class suburbs in the north of Noumea, the capital, particularly Kanak and Islander majority areas, that they were being disadvantaged. And indeed, there were court cases claiming that this was rigged. So, for example, there are no public buses on Sunday in the suburb of Rivière-Salée. And so people had to walk 4 or 5 miles to get to the polling booth. And there were calls for the local municipalities to run shuttle buses so that people could fulfill their democratic vote. And so there's been a lot of criticism from some Kanak parties, MNAS and others, that this was rigged and that they felt that the deliberate melding of bureaus from 56 down to 8 meant that would disadvantage poorer people who couldn't afford to drive to the polling booth or didn't have access to public transport. And, you know, for a lot of young people too, there's still a disillusionment with party politics, and that was seen during the riots. There are people who feel that the conservative parties that were the leading slates in Noumea, in Doumbéa, in Paita, didn't really represent their interests. There's a real sense that the battleground is still to come. The provincial elections, which are on a restricted electorate just of New Caledonian citizens rather than all French nationals, that will be a real test of where New Caledonia will go. This is an issue, of course, for the region, for the Melanesian Spearhead Group, for the Pacific Island Forum later this year, because the potential of a change of government with the provincial elections will sort of set a pathway. And, you know, ironically, just last night, Lionel Jospin, the French Prime Minister, who was part of the architecture of the 1998 Nouméa Accord, Lionel Jospin passed away in France. And it sort of symbolizes that we're coming to an end of a particular period with the Nouméa Accord in New Caledonia. The future, well, that's for New Caledonians to decide, and it's going to be a real tussle for months to come.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be a lot at stake for the upcoming provincial elections, that's for sure. Nick, we might leave it there because we are running out of time, but yeah, thanks so much as always for coming on the program and giving us that fantastic analysis.
Thank you, Kyle, as always. Speak to you again.
That was Island Business correspondent Nick McClellan. It is Tuesday, March 24, and you're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Kyle Evans, and if you're just tuning in, it's been a pretty busy show so far. We started in the Solomon Islands, where confidence is growing among opposition MPs who say they are now a government in waiting.
So if you're Prime Minister, you see more than half your cabinet resigning, that should be a sign that there is no confidence in your leadership.
Meanwhile, a new study has uncovered microplastics in Fiji's drinking water.
And I think the message that is going across to the people is that they should not start discarding plastics unwisely.
Stay tuned, because coming up, we'll learn why the World Bank holds fears for PNG.
Talo Falava, I'm Sosefu Omoli. Join me every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent mixed with the sounds and vibe our islander audiences love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune into Sister Sounds Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beats. A review into PNG's public finance by the World Bank Group has found that despite being resource rich, the country is not seeing returns. The resource sector has averaged just 1.9% of GDP over the past decade. It comes as the PNG government has outlined key goals for the country, aiming for 1 million new jobs and $200 billion keener economy by 2030 and a balanced budget by 2027. Han Freitas is the World Bank's division director for Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands and Vanuatu. He told Lucy Cooper, the goals are ambitious but achievable with change.
They are achievable. So that's one of the main conclusions of the report, is that these targets are achievable. Some of them are well underway to be achieved. The government is really undertaking a very ambitious effort for fiscal consolidation. But we also know that in order to achieve these ambitions, something has to change. If everything remains the same as today, they will not be achieved, but they can be achieved.
The review notes that PNG earns far lower dividends and tax revenue from the resource sector than comparable to other countries. Is this a barrier to achieving the goals it set out?
Absolutely. So the government should actually, in our view, and that's what the report concludes, do three main things. One is finding ways to increase revenues. And that's where your point on the resource sector comes in. But there's some other measures that the government can take. It also needs to find ways to spend better the money it's already spending. And then the third very important priority would be that the gains made from these two efforts would actually be invested in the health and the education of young people in Papua New Guinea. Papua New Guinea has a growing young population. They will be doing the jobs of the future. And so right now, the health and the education outcomes are lagging behind other countries. So that's an important third priority for the government.
The review estimates PNG could raise 1.7% of GDP from better resource revenue collection. What would implementing that actually look like in practice?
Yeah, so I would say there's a number of things the government can do. One is the extractive sector. We know that this economy is highly dependent on extractives. Extractives are being exploited, but what we're seeing is that the growth in the extractive sector is not translating in equal growth in government budget or government spending, and certainly not in human capital outcomes. So it's not keeping pace. So what the government would need to do, and that's a key recommendation that we have, is really to make sure it can make more money out of its extractives industry. First of all, this means that the dividends that are owed to the government, that they're actually being paid. The government has taken an important step to adopt a dividend policy. Now it needs to implement the policy so that it sees the money that is owed from the existing resource projects. Over time also, it would be important that when the government negotiates new resource projects, that it actually locks in better benefits for itself during those negotiations. They will materialize over time, but it's during the negotiations that you actually need to make that happen. Finally, that's an important point. We've seen that countries that actually make the best out of its extractive sector adopt rules of transparency around the sector, that audit reports are being published, that there is sufficient transparency in the sector, and there PNG can do a lot more as well.
The review also finds that any gains made should be invested in human capital. What exactly is that, and what does it look like?
Yeah, human capital, that's the people of the country, right? So it's the education and the health and the mechanisms that ensure that in a country the poorest people can get the help and the services that they need to develop themselves, right? So we have this human capital indicator that we look at, and it predicts that in PNG, a young person, when they grow up today, will only be able to realize about 40 to 42% of its full potential for the economy. That's not enough. Other middle-income countries in the world score better on these outcomes, and PNG should do better. It really means investing more in basic education, investing more in primary healthcare, and investing more in systems that allow the government to provide direct benefits to the poorest and the most vulnerable in the society. So the outcomes in learning and nutrition, for example, in PNG are very low. They're more comparable to a low-income country, not to a middle-income country. So some of the resources need to be redirected to basic education and basic healthcare.
Is there a path to fix all of this?
Yes, there are many examples of countries who've taken measures. There's no one path. This is a set of policies and implementation decisions that the government has to take and can take if they want to. They also do want to. Sometimes the circumstances are challenging, but it is possible to invest more in early learning, for example. There are mechanisms that we know of and that can be implemented here that actually provide incentives to school systems to make sure the kids are in the school. There are ways to make sure more school books are available to children. There are ways to invest in local service delivery through district funds or provincial development funds to make sure that the funds that go there, that every kina that is being invested in the local communities, that it is known what it is for and that it can be judged or monitored whether the investment has been worth it. So these mechanisms do exist and can also be implemented here.
That was Han Freitas, World Bank Division Director for Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands and Vanuatu. Well, today is World Tuberculosis Day. This year's theme is Yes, We Can End TB. The World Health Organization says it hopes this message of hope affirms that it is possible to get back on track and turn the tide on the TB epidemic, even in a challenging global environment. Joining Pacific Beat to discuss further is Naomi Pank, a clinical nurse and co-lead of the SWEEP TB project. Naomi, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
No, not a problem.
And happy World TB Day.
yes, thank you. now, Papua New Guinea has one of the highest prevalence rates of tuberculosis in the world, about 30,000 new cases reported every year. Well, why is that?
It's quite a probably complex question, as in there is no single or straightforward answer to this. So there are different areas that have different challenges, but in terms of the disease burden, we do have high number of TB cases detected heavy here. So yes, it could be, you know, related to resource constraints. It could be related to, you know, access to care. Some of the traditional challenges of people not being diagnosed and treated early, and so there's ongoing transmission. So for all the reasons that exist, ongoing transmission in the community seems to be one of the driving factors of the ITB burden in our country.
And is the number decreasing or is it increasing? Like, what do the result? What do the signs on the ground say?
It has been showing an increasing trend. There's in the last 3 to 4 years post COVID, there has been about 30% increase in TB cases in the country. Just last year, we had about 52,000 people diagnosed of TB, showing like 12% increase from 2024. So there is an increasing trend.
Yeah, interesting. And what tends to, spread the disease?
So one of our observations, and also from the reports that we see in the publications as well, people seem to be, diagnosed at a later stage. And having been diagnosed at a later stage does have an implication of transmission as well. So if you have the signs of TB, so for example, if you are coughing for more than 2 weeks, and if you have TB in the lungs and you are not diagnosed and treated, it does spread when you cough. And so when people who have TB disease, especially of the lungs, who do not, get diagnosed and treated early, it does spread to other people within their households or anyone they have contact with. And so, being late diagnosis and treatment could be a factor also in terms of the ongoing transmission. Yeah.
So it's one of those things that when it begins, it tends to start off quite mild, but if you don't sort of nip it in the bud quite early, it can grow serious quite quickly.
Exactly.
Yeah. So tell us about the Sweep TB project. You're the co-lead, and what is it?
So the Sweep TB project is a comprehensive approach, and it's more of a systematic approach where the model of care is we bring the TB care out to the community. Most resource-constrained countries, it's difficult to go out and do a full, full implementation of care for TB, as in you start with screening people, and then once you detect the disease or infection, you link them to the appropriate care pathway, and they are constant treatment, and then during treatment there's an ongoing support and follow up until they complete treatment, whether it be for active TB disease or TB infection. And so what the Sweep TB project has been doing is going out to the Highlands. So Darro is in Highland, and the project is based on the Highland. And what it has been doing is going to the households, bringing all the equipment and technologies, like doing X-ray using artificial intelligence, and there's mobile or portable X-rays that we can take into the communities and then use artificial intelligence called CAD for TB. And that does give us the reading of whether, it's indicative of TB or not. And so there is, direct link to the next stage of whether we get the sputum test or other samples needed to run through the gene expert machine and then do a diagnostic test to confirm whether it's TB or not, and then we get them treated. So there is this model of care where we are going to the community, we are using advanced technologies, we're trying to do on-the-spot diagnosis, and then link them to active treatment as soon as possible. So in that way, we are trying to reduce transmission. If there's anyone living in TB in the communities, we try to find them sooner, and then we try to get them on treatment sooner. And at the same time, in parallel with that, we're also screening for TB infection. So the difference is TB infection is it's still in your body, but you or people would not be sick. So it has not progressed into the stage where you become sick, but it's lying there dormantly. And so at any stage, it can come up again. So one of the you know, preventative measures is to test for the infection and treat for that infection so it does not progress into disease. So what we've done was do a skin test, tuberculin skin test. It's one of the tests for TB diagnosis as well, TB infection testing. And that testing itself does tell us whether someone has TB germ in their bodies or not, or in their systems or not. And if they do, then we do provide preventative treatments. And what the SWIP TB model has been doing is a combination of, you know, drugs that are not currently used within the routine TB program in the country. And so trying to see how effective that can be and how, you know, that can be taken up into the program as well. And treating, you know, population group that is above 5-year-old or, you know, adolescents and adults as well. So we're not focusing on children only. So there's been a lot of novel interventions to try to merge with the current existing TB program in terms of going out, screening for active TB disease, treating them as early as possible. And then, you know, if they do not have active TB disease, but they have skin, rather TB infection, then we treat them for the infection. So in essence, both of them try as much as possible to reduce transmission by early case, early detection and treatment, and then also like the attention or the aim for preventative treatment through infection diagnosis and treatment is to cut off transmission as much as we can. So that is what SWIP TB has been doing on the island.
Yeah,
and I guess, sorry, just to add one more point. It also has a community engagement component to it where we are doing community mobilization, awareness, all of that before going out with all the new technologies and the approach in the community. So there has been good uptake so far. Thank you.
Thank you for that answer. I mean, the technology the stuff that you mentioned really made my ears perk up, particularly the stuff about artificial intelligence. So are you able to essentially measure symptoms now using AI?
Yes. Simply, I would say yes. What it does is the X-ray, we set a certain score. So it does indicate once we get chest X-ray done, it will indicate a certain level of score based on what it picks up from the reading of the X-ray. And so if it's more or at least equal to the threshold, for SWIP TB, we're using 40 as a score in the CAD for TB. AI software that we're using for the screening. And so if it is, you know, 40 or more, then it is indicative of TB. That what it does is that it shows that you could or someone could have TB. And so we need to confirm with gene expert testing, and that is the gold standard. So
yeah.
Yes, you are correct in that way.
No, it's just fascinating what it can do these days. Now, you mentioned that a lot of this work is going to be carried out in the Highlands, which I imagine would be somewhat resource poor compared to places like Port Moresby. But I understand one of the other barriers to treating tuberculosis and the misunderstandings about the cause of the disease in those places is that locals tend to attribute it with witchcraft or the devil, and that can lead to stigma and discrimination for people with the disease. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, so TB, stigma in TB, like, you know, TB has been around in the world for some time, and even in PNG, despite awareness efforts, despite, you know, people, you know, being cured for TB and all that, stigma still does exist. And one of the reasons is what you've mentioned. So, you know, belief systems around TB disease being associated with sorcery, and that is, there have been like, this is an existing challenge as well in the communities. And so one of the experiences from Daru that has really sort of helped us see that it can be changed in terms of having people see that TB is an actual disease and it can be treated and it can be cured and people can survive or be free of it as well.
Yeah, and so hopefully that does change the stigma. Sorry to cut you off there, Naomi, but we're about to crash into the clock, so I'm going to have to stop the interview there. But look, it's a fantastic it's a fantastic project, and it sounds like it's got the makings of something that's going to be really successful. So thanks for coming on our program today, and all the best with it.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
That was Naomi Park, a clinical nurse from the co-lead of the new Sweep Tuberculosis Project. And that's all we've got time for on Pacific Beat today, but we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. My name's Kyle Evans. Have a fantastic day.